Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg, editor of the Herald Times in Bloomington, along with co-host Mary Catherine Carmichael, and our topic today is public education. Our guests are Jim Harvey, the superintendent of schools of the Monroe County Community School Corporation, and John Quick, who's the superintendent of schools in the Bartholomew Consolidated School Corporation. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811. Or if you're in Columbus or anywhere else outside of the Bloomington calling area, you can phone 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu.
Hey, before we get started, can I take a minute and congratulate one of the MCCSC's partners, the Bloomington Parks and Recreation Department? They won a national award on Wednesday morning, the Gold Medal Award for being the top parks department in the nation in their population size group. So congratulations to them.
Absolutely.
And part of the reason that was their partnership with MCCSC.
Yeah, great. Congratulations to Mick and to Mary Catherine, the former president of the Parks Board.
Yeah.
All right. Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
And John, welcome to you for the first time.
Glad
to have you. There are a lot of things going on in public education today. We can go a lot of different directions, but it's probably appropriate to start with what's happening with property taxes in the state, the big property tax issue. So if each of you could sort of frame that issue as it affects the public school system, each of your corporations. And Jim, let's start with you.
Well, I was actually going to defer to John
because
I think his situation is slightly different than ours. It's impacted school corporations across the state, actually on a county basis. It depends upon where your county is with regard to reassessment. In Monroe County, as everybody knows, at least in Monroe County, our property taxes bills were delayed and were due and payable the end of July, third week in July, or my recollection was that. So we did have to borrow some money because normally that distribution is made by June 30th. And that is a cost to the taxpayer simply because we have to pay interest on a loan just like everybody else. That's a microcosm, of the bigger problem across the state, and it really looks at going back to the Supreme Court case in Indiana several years ago, looking at school funding and the relationship between commercial and residential property. The problem right now across the state tends to be, if I understand it correctly, that a lot of the commercial property was not assessed according at the levels that it should have been. Therefore, there was a shift to residential property that in many cases was deemed to be disproportionate, had a severe impact in Marion County. At least we haven't had to give money back. I understand IPS has actually had to give some of their tax money back. So the biggest issue for us, I mean the short term, but the biggest issue is trying to do any kind of long-range planning. If you're trying to do – we're getting ready in 09 to go into a long-range facilities plan, first phase, and it makes it difficult to do, particularly when we had advertised the plan predicated on the assumption that we weren't going to raise tax rates.
Mm-hmm. John, I know you've got a similar but even more serious situation.
We have yet to receive any kind of property tax bills in Bartholomew County to this point. We're anticipating getting those bills in the end of October, maybe payable by the end of November. So we've been in a situation like Jim where we've had to borrow money for cash flow. So this is the most money in tax anticipation warrants, I think, in the history of BCSC. We have put so many things, I think, on hold, and Jim hit on the planning. For example, we had hoped last summer to bring forth a multi-phase high school addition and renovation project, and we pulled that project because we didn't have bills. We couldn't answer the question to folks about what their property tax bill would exactly be. And we've had two stories this week, one early in the week that the assessor said they would be an average of 8-9% higher. And then the auditor yesterday said, no, it's going to be 25-30% average higher. So we don't know. And until folks really get that, we can't answer the question. So although we don't control much of what happens there, we get a lot of the pressure. Three-quarters of your tax bill probably comes to BCSC. It might vary a little bit whether you live in the city or whether you live out in the county. But we certainly – folks are very much – when they look at their bill and they see that – We're in a situation where, you know, much of our budget, we have a $100 million budget, and probably two-thirds of that budget is local dollars in one way or the other. So we don't have another funding mechanism other than property taxes to do some building. So we certainly are anxious to see how that works. We don't think we're going to have the perfect storm like they had in Marion County. We have gone through the inventory tax, and we had a pretty good assessment. Our data given to DLGF, although it wasn't – they haven't had it all that long, they didn't kick it back and say your commercial and your home property is really askew, and so you need to do this over. So they said we had pretty good data. So we're looking forward to those bills, but we're under pressure. I know a lot of folks are looking at this next legislative session to see what might happen with property tax reform.
Yeah. I guess the one thing I would want to say about this whole issue is that – and I know that there's a lot of clamoring across the state and maybe in our two counties in particular to do something about the property taxes. But as a revenue stream, I would be very cautious of going away from property tax. And I know that there's a lot of conversation and concern about that. But when I look at what the General Assembly is considering as options – one of the things that we have to do is to, and we both alluded to it or spoken to it, is this issue of planning. And the options that the General Assembly are considering are less predictable, less reliable sources of income. And you get into a recession, for example, and sales go down, then your revenue stream goes away. And so I'm really concerned about some of the conversation that's going on at the state level about doing away with property tax totally as a basis for school funding. I'm also concerned about what has transpired from the time that the original property tax bills were passed in the early 70s that were designed to shift the burden of the funding of local schools to the state. And since that time, the erosion of it, that and John, our figures are slightly less than theirs, but are right now about 60%, 61% of our general fund revenue comes from local property taxes and only about 39-40% from the state. 35 years ago in 1972, it was reversed. These are the historic ratios that we had prior to Governor Bowen, and now we're back almost where we started, but we have all the controls that came out of that era.
Could you both speak to where your money for building comes from versus your operating funding?
Well, the funds for building is totally a local function. Now, we have to get approval from different folks along the way, including DLGF and folks at the state level.
DLGF?
Department of Local Government Finance.
Okay. Oh,
thank you.
So we're used to using these acronyms. But I agree with Jim that we need property tax. The stability's there. What happens, folks will say, let's do away with property tax, but the levy or the amount of money that we need, that doesn't change, and there isn't any free lunch. So if you're not going to do property tax, what's the other source? There has been some relief, I think, in property tax that probably goes unnoticed, and that is the single largest chunk of money in a state budget is for education. But the next largest chunk of money is actually property tax replacement now. So there have been some things that have happened over the last few years because there's been pressure. And so that property tax replacement is a big part now of what would be the state budget. And some could argue that maybe that those dollars should have been earmarked for education rather than – so I know it's a complex issue and there's a lot of emotion around it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to solve it, I don't think, in a one short legislative session.
But to specifically answer your question, of the funds that we have in the various categories, whether it's transportation or debt service or capital projects, the only one that has any state support to it is the general fund. The rest of them now are all based on local property tax.
And the general fund is used for?
Broad category is basically operating expenses in terms of, and in our case, about 85-90% goes for salaries and salary-related fringe benefits. So that's where most of your money goes. We've had some bleed over in recent years, again, with General Assembly approval of moving some costs over into the capital projects fund, specifically in the area of utilities.
Mm-hmm.
But basically your general fund is really your main operating fund. The other funds tend to be they're almost categorical in the sense that they're very specific and they're very tightly controlled.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for explaining that.
Yeah. All right. 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and noon@indiana.edu. Our guests today are Jim Harvey, Superintendent of Schools in Monroe County Community School Corporation, and John Quick, Superintendent of the Bartholomew Consolidated School Corporation. I'm struck by, you know, our first 10 minutes of conversation here about both of you, I'm sure, started as teachers. I know you both served as principals. You had a lot of contact with students. Yet, you know, we opened the program. We spend a lot of time on probably the number one issue facing you today, which is, you know, financial and how to make these budgets work. There are so many things that superintendents of schools are responsible for. So, you know, we hope to cover many of them today. I want to go to another one that has to do with serving, you know, all the students in your corporations. I know, Jim, we've had, I was fortunate enough to go on the trip to Napa with you to look at New Tech High School. I know that Bartholomew County also has a lot of sort of different ways of trying to teach students. Mm-hmm. So if you could each sort of talk about the importance of trying to serve students in a different kind of setting and trying to you know, how you in 2007 try to reach all students who may learn in different ways. And let's just start with John on this one.
Okay. At the high school level, we've talked about pathways, having multiple pathways. We have two pretty large comprehensive high schools, 1,500 and one's a little more than 2,000. So when students walk in the door, they have multiple pathways and ways in which we can regroup students also into maybe schools of 400 or 500 in that particular pathway so that there's better ownership. And, you know, our goal is that every student every day has an adult in that building that knows them well and can help advise them. And that's awfully important to our students. In broad terms, you know, you would look at what is a school of one. Each student should have an individual plan or someone that helps advise them as they progress through that. We're looking at New Tech implementation in the fall of 2008. We're looking at this from kindergarten through 12th grade. All the New Techs that I'm aware of are high school. But we think this project-based learning in a technology-rich environment is good for all students. So one of our smaller elementary schools that is high poverty will become a magnet school this fall, and we're trying to figure out how we make all those logistics work. We're also going to take a couple of teams in a middle school there that will be on the same campus as that elementary school and make them a new tech school, as well as looking at then starting the beginning of with 100 high school students and eventually getting to 400 with the new tech. And I know you're familiar with that, mm-hmm. with that process. But we need to have many more options for students. We have so many veneers of students in our district, whereas our top 10% outperform the top 10% in the country. We also have 40% lunch assistance and 10% students with English as second language and 38 languages spoken, and the diversity there and the needs, you know, one size doesn't fit all. So mm-hmm. how do we look at this education system differently? Because what we're seeing is that we have to increase the engagement. If students are not engaged, then we feel like that we're, you know, you win in the battles maybe at this level, but we lost the war because the student is not with us at the end and being a lifelong learner. So those are the big ideas for BCS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim?
Ours are similar. It's interesting. The semantics that we use or how we phrase things, John talks about pathways. We've simply talked about options. Of giving kids choices, as many choices as we can, which is kind of interesting in terms of counterbalance with the state requirements, which continue to increase in terms of Core 40. We, too, will begin a new tech high in the fall. And I think we've presented it as a different way for kids to learn. It is structured very differently than a traditional high school, and it will impact the traditional high schools. It has already impacted, for example, our middle schools. Mm-hmm. I started meeting in the spring semester with our middle school principals, which resulted in a recommendation to our board in June to create a middle school task force this year to look at our middle schools and how our middle schools maybe need to change and be restructured to meet the different kinds of changes that we're looking at in the high schools. We also plan to start an early college high school in the fall that will be a school within a school, programs both at North and South, focused primarily on 21st century scholars. We have not had a good track record historically with actually getting these kids to enroll in college. In fact, our rate is very low in the 12% to 15% range, and that's really unfortunate because this is a terrific program that's available to those students.
Could you explain the program, the 21st Century Scholarship?
Well, very very briefly, it focuses on students that are identified in middle school who are so economically disadvantaged, but clearly have from standardized tests the academic ability to do higher education. And basically, what happens is that the student elects with the support of their parents to in effect sign a contract that says, I will stay in school, I will stay out of trouble, not take drugs, graduate with a certain GPA, and in return, State of Indiana says we will provide a four-year scholarship to a state school.
And so you're having people not take you up on that offer?
Only 12 to 15% of the some 400-plus students that we have in our two high schools actually end up enrolling in college. And you know, as we talk about, I mean, Tom Friedman's book's now about 2 years old, but if we continue to have that conversation about what he says will be the next great revolution in American education, and that is, you know, students going into higher education, we have to change that percentage. I mean, look at the number of children or families that would be affected if we simply doubled the number. Or what if it became similar to what our normal student population looks like, which I don't know what Columbus's numbers look like, but in our high schools we're looking at, let's say, 70% or in that neighborhood plus or minus 5%. So if you had 70% of those kids going to college, what an enormous impact it would have on them, their families, and quite frankly, you know, on our community in terms of what the kind of contributions they would make to our society.
Mm-hmm. All right. I wanted to follow up on the early college because you mm-hmm. you know, New Tech High School and John, what you said, project-based learning in a technology-rich environment. I think that and Jim, we've had this conversation. I think people are starting to understand what New Technology High School is, which is not about a bunch of people learning about technology. Right. I mean, it's a different way of learning things. So, but early college, I'm not as familiar with that. So what would that be?
Well, there are a variety of early college models, and the one that we're focused on is trying to – again, we focused on this particular population. Mm-hmm. Other early college models don't necessarily focus on the same group of students that we did. We simply looked at our data with regard to our students and realized that we had a significant target population here that was not being responsive to what we saw as a very – generous opportunity as far as the state's concerned, and what can we do to help that? So we actually, again, will be identifying students in middle school, putting together a prescribed curriculum that would start with them as freshmen, providing a lot of additional support in two ways. One, academic support, but also what I would call cultural support. I'm reminded of one of the scenes in the movie Breaking Away where the father takes his son over here on campus and they're standing outside the library. And basically this was the father's way of trying to encourage his son to consider coming to IU. But I always was struck by that scene in terms of the dichotomy that's there, that this was not part of the horizon for that father, but he was trying to communicate to his son that this was something that he ought to consider. And it was telling that scene was filmed at night. that the father wasn't going to be seen on campus during the day with his son. And I think some of our families, quite frankly, feel that way about whether it's IU or Ball State or Ivy Tech. And so we're planning a number of cultural activities for the parents. And in fact, the early college program will require an agreement to be signed by the part of the parents that they will attend some of these activities on the campus to help them understand that this is something that's achievable and doable on the part of their family, on the part of their son or daughter.
Mm-hmm. John,
we have agreements with IU PUC at the campus at Columbus and Ivy Tech, Vincennes, Purdue School of Technology. And as a matter of fact, as a single site now, more of our students choose to go to what we call the airport campus there in Columbus than go to what land-grant college is now. And part of it's economics, and part of it is these first generation. About 70-80% of those students that might be first generation students. And we think that's important because we battle what Jim does with 21st Century Scholars, that folks don't know – sometimes the students don't know what they don't know because mm-hmm. they haven't had that modeling in there. But it will be our expectation, for example, in many of our pathways that you have 12 to 24 hours of college credit when you graduate. Matter of fact, we've had a high school interdisciplinary team of about 100 to 120 students for some years now, and those teachers that work in that unit, in that group of school within a school, are now adjunct faculty. And then those students will have an associate degree in a few years. They will graduate high school with an associate degree. Now, the economics of that, plus the head start and the expectation that students go on to higher ed, is a real important mindset, getting and touching those students early on where they feel like they're connected to higher ed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, our phone numbers again, 855-0811, 877-285-9348, and the email address is noon@indiana.edu.
All right, well, you'll be happy to know our first question is from Columbus.
All right.
It begins, what new ways are you planning to challenge high-performing and or gifted children at all levels in the district, but especially at the elementary level? Right now, it is my experience that they are underserved and can become unengaged.
Okay. We do have what we call academic challenge program that starts in fourth grade, mm-hmm. On which those students are identified, and then we do those programs at two cluster sites. What we're looking at is other ways of reaching all of students. Universal Design for Learning is a big part of what we're doing now, and it was based on the architectural concept or the Americans Disability Act. It says all buildings should be accessible. Mm-hmm. Well, the same way, all curriculum should be accessible. And when we look at this School of One idea, it's real important to challenge those students. I think technology is one of the ways that we can do that. The reader probably sounds like someone who sometimes their child may be frustrated because it seems like there's artificial ceilings on kids, and I think that's an injustice too. So we're looking at, in addition to those programs, there's a committee, our academic challenge committee is looking at other alternatives, but we certainly want to serve students on across the broad spectrum, and that's what we have in Columbus is so many different veneers, mm-hmm. and serving challenge is serving those students at all of those level and making sure that we look at the students as a population and moving everyone across that continuum.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Jim, any comments about MCCSC and elementary sort of enrichment?
Yeah, our situation probably similar to Columbus's, but a little different. This year, again, the General Assembly passed a new law that basically changes the definition of what are now referred to as high ability students.
Did that used to be gifted?
Yes.
Okay.
And we, too, have a broad-based planning committee, but the redefinition of this actually broadens out the definition of who qualifies. Historically, in our district, at least at the elementary level, it's been a fairly narrow a definition, fairly strict, and I think the legislation's changing that. And so during the course of this school year, we're looking at what that impact would be. We're looking, I think, at, again, we've had a pullout program for more than 20 years focusing on the humanities, and it has attracted a single section of students, again, in each grade level, 4, 5, and 6. The conversations that I've had with the Broad-Based Planning Committee have been about the areas that we're not necessarily serving. If you're looking at the broad spectrum of giftedness of how children might excel, we've tended, for example, to focus on academic pursuits rather than some others. You may have students that are gifted or extraordinary in the arts. Mm-hmm. We've not done a real good job, at least recently, in that area. We also have not really served kinetically children that are gifted in that respect. And currently, we don't have any focus program in the sciences or mathematics. And so we've got some work to do in that, and I think that this is paralleling to some extent what we're looking at in the conversation about middle schools, that we've also created a task force this year to look at what do we need to be doing better for our high-ability kids. And in some instances, the idea that John mentioned about programs in each school, we're looking at some considerations, some ideas about ungraded programs in each school, at least in the intermediate grades, that would allow students to work at their own pace, have more flexibility than maybe they would have in the traditional structure. So this is an area where, quite frankly, there's a real desire on the part of parents to keep their children in their home elementary school, their neighborhood school, and so it's hard sometimes to attract or involve them in cluster programs or those kinds of things. They tend to do that more readily in the middle schools and high schools, but it's a concern for us that we don't know that we've served our elementary children as well as we should have.
Our guests today are Jim Harvey, Superintendent of Schools of the Monroe County Community School Corporation, and John Quick, Superintendent of the Bartholomew Consolidated School Corporation. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. Or you can send your email to noon@indiana.edu. We'll get to an email as soon as we get back from a break. You're listening to Noon Edition. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Noon Edition on member-supported WFIU. Production support comes from Closets 2, providing organized and expanded closet and storage space for home office and garage using a variety of systems with no major renovations. Closets 2 owned and operated in Bloomington, 332-2233. And from South Dunn Street Project, represented by Brian Lappin Real Estate, classic bungalow-inspired architecture in the Bryan Park neighborhood of Bloomington, www.southdunnstreet.info. Speak Your Mind is WFIU's two-minute commentary, allowing you to air your thoughts about current global or local issues. To submit your idea or for a set of guidelines, you may call 855-1357 or visit wfiu.org. Speak Your Mind is WFIU's Letters to the Editor commentary show.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Salzberg from the Herald Times, along with Mary Catherine Carmichael and our guests today, Jim Harvey and John Quick. Jim is superintendent of the Monroe County Community School Corporation, and John is superintendent of the Bartholomew Consolidated School Corporation. If you have questions or comments, please phone us at 855-0811 or 877-285-9348. That's 285-9348. Or send your email to noon@indiana.edu, as one of our listeners has done.
They have indeed. And this one is directed to you, Jim. Your service to the children of our county is appreciated. Do you consider IDEA an underfunded mandate? And you're going to have to tell us what IDEA is.
IDEA is the federal legislation pertaining – basically the federal rules with regard to special education.
Okay. And there are several questions, so I'm going to let you answer these one at a time if you don't mind. I think it might be simpler.
Okay.
All right. The first one is, do you consider that to be underfunded?
It generally has been.
Okay. How much money has been given to Indiana schools from the federal government for IDEA?
I don't know that I can answer that.
Okay. Do you know how much has been given to MCCSC?
I don't specifically in terms of broken down. Our director of special ed clearly would know, but John, you might.
Well, I can make a couple of general comments. First of all, education is pretty much a local and state function. So in any given year, the amount of federal dollars, including Title I dollars and that, is certainly less than 10% of our budget. We spend about $9 million in our district serving 1,600 students, and we're the local educational agency. So we work with six school corporations and some students that might be low incident. But the problem we have just immediately, and I probably is what the reader was going after, we were anticipating a 5% increase in funding for this year. And matter of fact, that's what the budget says at the federal level. In fact, we got 5% less dollars. So that was a $600,000 shortfall. And so when you contact folks and say, you know, how could this be? Because we planned on this and yet we have a $600,000 shortfall. And some of that money, I think, actually went in the war efforts. And so so those students who need the most help sometimes are underfunded. Students with special needs, there is a, in the formula, instead of counting as 1.0, there might be a factor, added factor to that. But that doesn't fill the gap between what is the service that we need. So the answer to the question is yes, woefully underfunded.
Okay. And this continues. Are the federal funds specifically marked for special ed, or does it go into the general fund?
It's specific in terms of the dollars that come out. We don't have the luxury of – in other words, you're not going to have dollars that flow our way for students with special needs and then that money go into general fund. That's not the way – that it would work for us.
And then does MCCSC have sufficient funds to meet the needs of our special education population?
I think the answer to that generally is going to be no. I mean, it's a combination of state funds, local funds, and federal funds. But again, you're dealing with a finite amount. There is a dissonance there, quite frankly, between us and a lot of the families with special needs children that we can't provide all the services that they would like to have. And sometimes there's a difference, obviously, and a disagreement with regard to what is appropriate and what's optimal. And it's rare that we provide optimal services. It's just not within the financial reach of our ability to do. As I look at how education has changed, this is probably the most significant area in terms of the children that we have in schools today that we did not have a generation ago. And I'm not saying that we don't want them and we shouldn't have them. I'm just simply saying that in terms of the resources, that in many instances we're being asked to provide services that are very difficult for us to do. And there are some real gray areas in terms of education function and, quite frankly, what I consider sometimes to be mental health functions, what I consider to be medical functions, that services that we're providing and required to provide and it makes – that our competition, for example, for employees is not with Bartholomew County Community Schools. It's with Bloomington Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That when we're trying to hire occupational therapists or physical therapists or speech-language pathologists, many times that we're not competing with other school corporations. It's medical institutions. And I know they have their funding problems as well, but that part is very different from what some people will remember. This is what it was like when I went to school, the delivery of special needs services. It's frustrating for parents in many instances, and it's a source of frustration for us as well. But I think that by and large, we do a good job, but we don't provide all the services that a lot of these families would like to have.
I want to read the last part of this question. It's more of a comment, but I think it's important that we express this. It says, all questions are obviously related that we just asked, but the last is the most important to me. I have a child with special needs in this county. I provide volunteer occupational therapy service to him and many others in his schools because I perceive that we have a shortage of staff and funds. So, yes, echoing certainly your comments on that. Thank you.
All right. Let's talk about student performance and achievement and And also the assessment of how well students are doing. No Child Left Behind has been, you know, in effect for how many years now?
Five
years. And I think it's up for reauthorization perhaps this year. But what's been the impact of No Child Left Behind? What would you hope – what changes would you like to see in terms of how our government agencies want the schools to evaluate how well students are doing? Jim?
Oh, John.
another show for this, gentlemen?
More than willing to let John go first. Well, there are some just some real incongruities. One of the things that I read this morning about the reauthorization was a desire on the part of the federal government to increase the requirements for what they call highly qualified teachers. And again, you don't have any quarrel with that. Except that, you know, it puts pressure on you in terms of the recruitment. It puts pressure on us in terms of what we pay in terms of salaries. And then we have some peculiar kinds of things. Our state began a mentor program, an intern mentor program to help beginning teachers some 20 years ago. And the General Assembly this year chose not to fund a stipend for the mentors. That they've said, you know, we've historically for more than 20 years paid a mentor, a veteran teacher who would help a beginning teacher to get off on the right foot and to learn some of those things now in the real world that maybe they didn't learn when they were student teaching or a methods class. And the stipend was not a very large one. It was $600. But if you have 80 people, as we do, and there historically has been an expectation that you would pay them a stipend, and the state says, well, we don't think we can afford it, and you get zero, that's a lot of money. I mean, you say, yes, your budget's $90 million. That's true, all funds combined. But even, I mean, this sounds funny. I mean, I don't mean it in a demeaning way, but $48,000 is still a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But that's just a little bit about the No Child Left Behind. I guess I would say generally that I have no quarrel with assessment. I have really no quarrel with the standards that we're asking our kids to meet, because I think by and large our kids are doing pretty well. What I'm concerned about, quite frankly, is the lack of any common sense, flexibility in the application of some of the standards. And quite frankly, I don't want that flexibility to be here. It could be in Indianapolis. Don't let our school board have that flexibility. But we have a situation which is well known in Bloomington with Fairview that is a school that made academic performance. They are a failing school. In one subcategory, special education attendance, and there's a very good explanation for it, but there's nobody to whom the explanation can be given or anybody that's, quite frankly, willing and interested in listening to it. So that part of the unreasonableness doesn't make a lot of sense.
So wait a minute. Let's back up on that just a second. So it's failing in one subcategory, and
yes.
So therefore – it is considered to be a failing school.
They did not make AYP. They did not make the prescribed standard in every category in terms of the general school population or in terms of all of the subcategories. You have to make all of them. The general school population in terms of a school attendance rate or in the case of the high schools, graduation rates. You have to meet the performance criteria. But you also have to meet the attendance, all of these in the subcategories. Subcategories are free and reduced, limited English proficiency, and special ed. And this school qualified in every one of the broad categories, every one of the subcategories, with the exception of special ed attendance. And even that is related to a particular subgroup of students within that population. And so it's just – there's part of that part I would like to see some – common sense applied to the standards. The other last piece, and then I know John wants to weigh in on this, is the fact that I really feel like that when you look at the sanctions that are applied to a school, why do we go to choice as the very first option or sanction on a school? because it has really worked to the detriment of Fairview. When our board redistricted, we had 60% free and reduced in that school. But because of choice, the children who and families who have elected to leave, by and large, are not families that are free and reduced lunch, nor children who failed ISTEP. So all it has done has increased the density, the concentration in that school, made it more difficult for it to succeed, which it's done. That it seems to me that choice could clearly be one of the options or sanctions that you might want to levy, but why is it the first? And it makes, for example, redistricting really not a real possibility.
Mm-hmm. It also teaches our children if things aren't going well, you abandon ship.
Well, I'm not going to comment.
Well, I believe in accountability. I believe that No Child Left Behind is at least that term is going to be with us forever, I'm pretty sure. And I think the intent was good. I think there's some inconsistencies. And there's also this raising the bar toward perfection in which eventually almost everyone will fail. And that's really tough for us to work with faculty and staff. Let me give you two examples of the inconsistency just within my district. Two examples. I have an elementary school of 20-some percent lunch assistance, small elementary, very supportive parents, mostly rural. They were a four-star school. That means that they score in the top 25% in attendance, ISTEP math, ISTEP language, ISTEP kind of attendance, all of that. And that if you do all those things, then you're in the top 10% of all schools in the state. They failed adequate yearly progress and No Child Left Behind because they passed 14 out of 15 cells. The cell that they didn't pass was the segment of students with special needs that needed to increase their percentage of improvement by X amount. So they were failed. I have another school that has 80% lunch assistance, has about 90% mobility. That means if they have 400 kids in the school, probably 375 will move in and out in the course of a year.
In the course of 1 year.
In the course of 1 year. We have they have 22% of their students with special needs. They also passed 14 out of 15 cells, but they failed the same cell. But they've done it over a course of years now, and so that they're in a different classifications. So Indiana already had an accountability system called Public Law 221 before this came in, and so we're caught up in multiple accountability systems where a school could maybe pass on one and not on the other, and they don't even look at the same group of kids. And what is unfair sometimes is you want to look at an individual student or a group of cohort students. The school that I mentioned that was high poverty, if you stay with us for 6 years, you've got a 90% chance of passing that test. But and so do you know, do the teachers make a difference? Do we make a difference with students? Absolutely. But there's some other factors that are inconsistent. So it is in some ways kind of a PR nightmare for a superintendent. Quite frankly, I spoke to a lot of community groups and they would say, how in Columbus, Indiana, could you have a school that's failing or might be on probation? You know, because they don't understand. Mm-hmm. Because if you and I took a test and we passed 14 out of 15, we'd probably say, you know, we want to pass it all and we're going to work on that one and we've identified. And that's a positive thing in terms of segmenting the data and looking at groups of students and make sure that we have strategies to address those problems. But on the other hand, would you say to those teachers, you're a failing school, whereas you might have another school in which, you know, maybe the effort is not quite as intense, but they happen to be a little more lucky on the student that's walking through the door.
Well, not only a PR nightmare, but a morale issue, I would think, if you've got people doing the best they can and then they get painted with
Absolutely. And we have, almost 10% of our students, as I mentioned earlier, are English as second language. Now, those students will take the math portion and the science portion. They might opt out of the language portion if they haven't been with us for a period of time. And they can opt not to take the test, but it's a catch-22. If you don't take the test, then you fail. So you can opt not to take the test, but we're going to count it against you.
Yeah.
So there are some things where, you know, you're just trying to serve kids and you're trying to – but you know, we're sitting here talking about it, and it's confusing to most anyone while us trying to help with the folks. So
very similar kind of experience. The limited English proficiency is, again, another one where you have this whipsaw in terms of funding. This year, our state funding went up and the federal funding went down almost the commensurate amount. So the budget stayed the same. It's just the sources shifted. Mm-hmm. Yet our number of students continues to rise. I guess I would go back to what I had said earlier with regard to the reauthorization is that I really wish somebody would just use some common sense with some of this, that it doesn't serve us and I think to end up with a significant number of our schools identified as failing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we anticipate the same kinds of scenario that John mentioned, not this year, but next year when the standards go up, we anticipate that, and I've said this to our board, we won't have one Fairview. We will have at least probably four and could be more in terms of schools that will, under the No Child Left Behind legislation, be labeled as failing schools. And in many ways, just as we've been somewhat powerless to change the dynamic as far as Fairview is concerned, we will be just as powerless to change some of the dynamics as far as some of the other schools are concerned. That may not be real popular to say that, but I think that's out there. Mm-hmm. But I don't find when I read what the conversation and the discussion in Congress is, I'm not optimistic that we're going to see significant changes in the bill or in the law when it is reauthorized. I'm just sorry. I don't see it.
Okay. We have a phone call and an email. So let's go to Jim on the phone. Jim?
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jim.
Catherine and Jim Harvey. In 1957-58, when I came out of Cleveland with my master's, I worked for Purdue for a year, and I tested hearing according to the laws from border to border in Indiana. And in Brown County, I did many schools that don't exist anymore. And it was like Little House on the Prairie all over again. And I would urge you to keep the idea of small schools even within a school, and also to make sure the student gets a chance to visualize himself as a college student. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for the call.
Here's an email that came in. It's really not a question, a comment. It says, a note about funding for IDEA, GT, and all other programs. Lack of adequate funding is not about you. Our schools are greatly underfunded and are likely never to be properly funded. If you want additional funds for your programs, go to the polls and vote for folks who will fund them. That is, if you can find any candidate who will admit to being in favor of full funding for any government program.
Well, that takes me back to the idea of No Child Left Behind. And what kinds of things can you two do as superintendent or your association do in terms of lobbying with Barron Hill or with our senators to try to make the kind of changes you think are necessary?
Well, in the short run, I'm not optimistic. Mm-hmm. I believe that those mechanisms and the increase in the standards will get to us before we take any action, because I'm looking at the dates and looking at the political climate and, mm-hmm. and so forth. So they're going to get here before. So again, we will be fixing this after the fact, I think, once we get there. So I'm not optimistic. I think folks have a better understanding. I mean, I respect Barron and our local folks, and they have been helpful to the schools, and we have a good relationship with them. But I'm not in the long run. I think folks will come around, but in the short term, I think we're going to be taking some lumps.
Yeah.
Well, I think too that this is obviously a federal law, and the circumstances in education in Bloomington or Columbus are drastically different than they are in Indianapolis or Detroit or New York City, and it doesn't mean that you know, there ought to be, in a sense, different standards or different rules for us as opposed to them. But we really are talking about, in some of those scenarios, apples and oranges. And I really applaud what Gene White and, quite frankly, the mayor have done in Indianapolis in trying to create a better educational environment for the students that live in Indianapolis. They're dealing, though, with a different set of problems than we are, or at least simply in a greater number than we are. We still have them, but we don't have them to the extent that they do.
We don't have much time left, but I'd just like to ask each of you, if you had one wish that you could grant for your school system, what wish would that be?
You've puzzled them.
Well, that every student that walked in the door felt that they were connected and felt some ownership for their learning.
Okay.
I would second that. I think that I want each student to know that we really care, that we care about them as human beings, as people first, as students second. We want them to succeed. I want, quite frankly, and this is more than one wish, isn't it? But I want our society to recognize that this is probably the most significant investment that they can make, and that I hope that they would spend what they need to make sure that kids have the choices and the chances that we all hope for.
Okay, and we are out of time with that. I want to thank Jim Harvey. Jim, I hope you'll come back again. Hope you enjoyed
thank you, Bob.
It. And John, welcome for the first time. I hope you'll come back, too.
Anytime.
All right. These conversations about what's going on in the public schools is incredibly important, and we enjoy having
helpful.
Them. I want to thank Mary Catherine for being here today.
My
and
pleasure.
For producer Catherine Hageman and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Salzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at wfiu.org.